ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You write in the book that fibre may not be sexy, but the science of fibre truly is. One of the early examples you give of that science was a fairly comprehensive faecal survey.
I love that you picked that out as the sexy science.
When discussing dietary fibre, it's easy to stray into uncomfortable territory. Fecal surveys, stool bulk, digestive transit times, rates of flatulence. For some, this other end of eating is, well, it's just too awkward to even mention. Thankfully, we have communicators like Dr. Joanna McMillan to normalise these more sensitive conversations about our nutritional health.
Well, I think it's that we don't talk about it, so people don't know what's normal, you know, because in polite company, you don't really talk about these things.
Joanna's new book is called The Fibre Factor. And beyond its frank insights into gut health, it explores how fibre has faded from the modern diet.
Things like antioxidants and polyphenols and all of these many hundreds of compounds that are present in plant foods, we've thrown those out to get to those sort of modern packaged ultra-processed foods.
You are probably not eating enough fibre. And it seems that it isn't just your gut health that feels the consequence.
The gut microbiome fermenting fibres and other things in your gut and your colon is actually sending all sorts of signals via the vagus nerve up to your brain, and that impacts many aspects of brain health.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science and history collide. This week, hi fibre, is it time to reboot your biome? I want to start, Joanna, with a fairly foundational question. What is fibre?
Well, it's the a good way to think about it is it's actually carbohydrate, and I like to say that because people have such often have a negative, you know, association with carbs. But fiber are carbohydrates too. They're just carbohydrates that we lack the enzymes to break down, and some of them are fermented by our gut microbiome, though, so they become food for the gut microbiome. Some of them pass straight through us, and some of them do other things as they pass through the gut. So fibers, you know, largely been forgotten about for that reason, because we don't break it down ourselves. But actually now we really understand why it's so important for us, for not just gut health, but way beyond, from everything from your gut to your brain and everything in between.
Is it that not breaking down bit that's important?
In part, yes, because, you know, I often say to people, you have to think these days about not just feeding yourself, but feeding your gut microbiome. So the fact that we don't break it down actually is important, because that's why it carries on through our small intestine and it reaches the large intestine, also called your colon. And that's where many of the magic is happening. So we can talk about what happens at various roles at various stages, right from within your mouth, right the way to coming out the other end. But it plays various roles along that pathway. But one of the absolutely key ones for the knock-on effect throughout the rest of the body are the fermentable fibres that are fermented in the colon.
Because if you do talk, you know, mention fibre to most people, they will jump immediately to the other end.
Yes. And we can't talk about fibre without talking about the other end. So, I mean, certainly when I was growing up, I remember, you know, it was one of the things my mum would talk about, calling it roughage, you know, and you had to have roughage or otherwise, you know, you didn't have a happy ending in the toilet. So that is indeed one of its very crucial and important roles. But it's actually doing a whole lot more than that.
Well, I mean, one of the important and crucial things here, of course, is that the studies suggest, as you write, that none of us, almost none of us, are getting enough.
which is pretty extraordinary, really. You know, a colleague of mine actually wrote a paper on the six nutrients of most concern in Australia, and fibre was one of those. So I think we've definitely forgotten about fibre. We inadvertently lost it. We didn't mean to throw out fibre, I think, because it was just thought of as, if we think about whole grains, it was that sort of rough, and it was thought of as a rough, indigestible part. So therefore, we could just, you know, rub that off the grain, get rid of it, and have white rice, white flour to make fluffy white breads and bakery and everything else, that sort of biscuits and all the things that have come from that. And we've inadvertently chucked out a part of the plant food that we didn't realise was playing such a crucial role. So I talk in the book in the early chapter about what happened to fibre, and it was really that modernisation of food, industrialisation, producing supermarket shelf-stable foods, which many of them are very good. You know, they limit food waste. They have allowed us a lot more freedom, especially women. You know, go back a few centuries and women were spending hours in the kitchen preparing foods. This sort of modernity that's happened has had some good effects, but one of the bad effects, the side effects of that that was not intended, was this loss of fibre and the impact that that's had on our health. So I talk you through what I call the fibre gap that is happening not just in Australia, but all around the world, even in developing countries now, as they increasingly move towards these ultra-processed, modernised foods, which were seen as a sort of sign of progress and modernity, without realising these full consequences to our health.
It's an escalating process, isn't it? I mean, and as you say, this goes right back to the introduction of sort of technology around food, to the modernisation of food processes. But that's a thing of the 18th century, of the 19th century.
That's right.
Never mind what we have now with ultra-processed foods, which is a problem of a different order.
Exactly. I mean, if we go back to way back when I was doing my PhD 20 odd years ago, I was very interested in evolutionary nutrition. And do you remember the days where we all talked about the paleo diet?
Well, that's pretty recent.
Yeah, well, that's closer. When I was doing paleo studies, when I was doing my PhD, no one was interested in the paleo diet apart from researchers. And then, of course, it became hugely popular in the public field many years later. But it does seem to have sort of died down. But nevertheless, the actual research is fascinating, to look at what did we eat back in Paleolithic days when we were hunter-gatherers, and then how has the human diet changed as we learned to farm, to stay in one place rather than be nomadic, and so on. And you can track these changes over time. But until relatively recently, and certainly the best Paleolithic data that comes not just from ancient hunter-gatherers, but from modern hunter-gatherer societies today that do still exist, they're eating somewhere in the region of 90, 100 grams plus of fibre. Now, put that in context, most Australians are eating somewhere in the low 20s, perhaps 21, 22 grams. And our recommendations are only around 25 to 38 grams, depending on the group that you're looking at. So you can see that our recommendations around the world for fibre are still about a third or so of what we used to eat. So that's pretty extraordinary. And that's really a sign of, as you say, the changes in food processing that happened. You know, I tell the story of you know, you can look online at these, the old adverts for the first Wonder breads, which was a white bread. You look in Asia, what happened culturally with the introduction of white polished rice, and the whole grain brown rices and other whole grain rices were sort of seen as peasant fare. You weren't modern and on the cusp of what's new and wonderful unless you had these kinds of new foods. And so it's a really interesting historical story.
I'm intrigued because we became more interested you studied Paleolithic nutrition, but the paleo diet was part of a movement where I think we were looking back to a different time when perhaps the food that we ate better suited the organisms that we are. And yet what we took out of that was protein. I wonder why that happened, why that was perhaps the misinterpretation of that period.
Well, I can tell you one of the reasons. One of the reasons is very simple. It's from a historical aspect and from archaeology and all of the tools that we have to try to work out what people were eating back then, the evidence that's left behind from hunting and from eating carcasses, from, you know, finding bones with knife marks on them, for example, you know, evidence of hunting is much stronger than the evidence there is for plants. You can imagine plants that just disintegrate and disappear, and therefore they're not leaving such a mark. And so, in fact, some of the very early paleo estimates have been shown to be incorrect in terms of the the ratio of animal to plant foods. So the best evidence we now have, which comes from people like Lauren Cordain's work and other people around the globe, have now shown that in fact we've always been omnivores, apart from some more, I mean, humans are remarkably adaptable to all sorts of different diets, unfortunately, just not our modern, highly processed Western diet. But diets around the world do differ. So you can find populations of humans who did follow more plant-based type diets. But largely, human beings have evolved as omnivores. We can see that from the structure of our intestines. We've got parts of our system that are more like true carnivores and parts of our system that are more like true herbivores. But we are actually omnivores. So we can digest and process and get nutrients from both animal and plant foods. And looking from a nutrition science lens, we can see that actually there are some nutrients that we best get from animal foods or only get from animal foods. And there are other things that we best get or only get from plant foods. And fiber is one of those. And fiber is an incredibly important part of including plant foods. So I think one of the things I really try to emphasize in this book is that my book is certainly not a plant-based eating manifesto. It's actually, I fully appreciate, and I am an omnivore myself, appreciate that nutrient-dense animal foods have a really key role. And what I say is whether you're an omnivore or a vegan or anywhere in that spectrum in between, we all need fiber-rich plant foods.
How adaptable is that human system? We talked there about the great changes that have happened in the way that we make and create food. And yet is our system of digesting that and taking nutrient from that, is that a fairly static entity in that path of progress?
Well, it's not static in that, you know, as we evolve, you know, I don't think it's correct to say we should all be eating the way our hunter-gatherer ancestors did. A, those foods are just not available anymore. There's very few foods, you know, perhaps oysters and mussels and some of those more...
Woolly mammoth is right out.
Yeah, or if we ate crocodile, I'm not sure, you know, none of the foods, you know, our meat is domesticated, our crops we've changed either to grow better, to be more uniform, to be able to be harvested, to put up with drought or other sorts of different ways of the way that we farm. So, you know, literally everything that we eat is very different to back then. But also our needs are different. Our lifestyles are very different. Our levels of activity, you know, we're using our brains often more than we're using our bodies. So there's all sorts of different things that have changed since then. But if we look again through that historical lens, I think what is pretty extraordinary, while humans are remarkably adaptable, we can survive in all sorts of different diets. And we see that if you travel the globe and look at the way people eat differently in different countries. We are very adaptable, but what we're not adapting to is the very quick, from an evolutionary sense, there's been a very quick shift to this sort of highly processed, packaged type of diet that we're not accustomed to, aligned with the fairly dramatic changes in our lifestyles. You know, so we are much more sedentary, we're spending more time indoors, we don't see the sunlight so much. There's all sorts of different reasons. Our levels of stress have very much changed. So all of those things have actually happened remarkably quickly. Now we can adapt. I mean, what's fascinating about looking at the gut microbiome, and we showed this actually when I was filming with ABC Catalyst, we showed this in measuring people's gut microbiomes, and we could see shifts in their gut microbiome in extraordinarily short periods of time. So your gut microbiome is one way that you adapt to different diets, and it can react much more quickly than our genes can change.
This is the thing though, isn't it? You argue, yes, that fiber has slipped off the modern process plate. I wonder if the story isn't more that we kind of no longer eat real food.
Yes, and in many ways we don't. I'm not totally against, you know, we've got a bit of in research circles as well as in the public domain, a sort of backlash against ultra-processed foods. But actually, speaking as a scientist and speaking in my intro, I said I was a food futurist. What I really mean by that is that I'm interested in how we need to change how we're growing food, so food systems from farm to fork, how we need to change those and adapt the way that we're eating in order to make sure that we're providing enough food for everyone and that we have a healthy diet available for everyone while looking after our planet. Now, so there have to be some changes. So some degree of processing and even ultra-processed foods are useful and help us to meet those aims. I'm also a scientist, so I appreciate the role that science plays in helping us to find solutions to some of the problems we have in feeding an ever-growing world population. So I don't want to diss all ultra-processed foods. But nevertheless, when we look at the average, let's just keep it within Australia, the average Australian diet, The problem is that we are eating too many dietitians have always called discretionary foods. So I think ultra processed foods is just a more term that's probably easier for most people to understand. So the problem is actually not just what the ultra processed foods are giving us, too much refined starch, too much added sugar, too many other additives that may not be doing our guts in particular good, like artificial emulsifiers and so on. But it's also what they're lacking. So they're lacking fiber, they're lacking particular nutrients. So we end up with this situation where we have many foods that are hyper palatable, they're very easy to overeat, they're incredibly energy dense. If you think about a typical fast food meal, it's actually not big in volume, but it's big on calories or kilojoules. Whereas if you go back to those more whole foods, fiber, one of the key roles it plays is that it's actually bulking up food. It's filling our stomachs up. The stomach then stretches and it's sending signals immediately to your brain to tell you food's coming in. You know, even once you start chewing food, you're getting those signals to the brain telling you food's coming in, dampen down appetite, get ready for an inflow of nutrients. And then those nutrients come and it's playing a role in getting the digestive rate right, slow absorption of carbohydrates so our blood sugar doesn't go all over the place. We're immediately getting release of various appetite hormones that again signal to the brain to stop telling us to eat more. And then the fermentation that happens down in the colon is doing that even more. I mean, we've got a flood of GLP-1 medications that are becoming increasingly popular, but fiber's doing it. It's stimulating your natural production of GLP-1, not to the incredibly amplified effect some of these medications are, but it's pulling multiple levers on your appetite. So it's a very important part of that system. And that's what we're missing out on. Along with all the nutrients and the what we call phytonutrients, which just means plant nutrients, so things like antioxidants and polyphenols and all of these other, you know, many hundreds of compounds that are present in plant foods that seem to be, and we're only just starting to understand what they are doing. So they're like the team players with fiber, and we've thrown those out as well in that processing to get to those sort of modern packaged ultra processed foods. So it's this sort of double whammy of what we're getting in ultra processed foods, but also what we're not getting.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. Today, you're meeting Dr. Joanna McMillan, nutrition scientist, dietitian, and author of The Fibre Factor, a science-backed guide to a healthier gut, stronger heart, and sharper brain. We began the program by alluding to a comprehensive fecal survey. Well, we've kept you in suspense long enough. I know you're dying to learn all about it. This pioneering research completely changed our understanding of fibre and its importance to our health. And it wasn't that long ago, the early 1970s, in fact. And the man who's most associated with this research is the Irish surgeon, Dennis Burkitt.
He travelled in Africa and he just started noticing the difference in the diet, and fibre levels in particular were very, very different. And they had very low levels of bowel disorders, so constipation, diverticulitis, cancer of the colon and so on. And so he was one of the first to make a kind of hypothesis around the importance of fibre. Now, of course, there's, as with any old research, there's, you know, with hindsight, people look back and try to pull apart some aspects of his research, as they always do. But it was actually groundbreaking. And at least in my mind as a nutrition scientist, he was definitely a pioneer of his time. And he opened up, the interest in fibre. And he really did start then people's understanding and researching of fibre happened since then. So that is extraordinary. And so fibre's story with bowel health and with, you know, poos and farting and all these sorts of things that people have studied. People have even, I do talk one of the other studies about how many times the average person farts a day. Now, I was not the research scientist who did that research, so don't ask me how on earth they worked that out.
They're still recovering.
Yes. But, you know, thank you to people who have done this kind of research, because that was really the starting point for really trying to look at these things and start to understand what more fibre is doing.
Is part of our problem with fibre, I mean, because presumably we should poo more and fart more if we were eating better. It is part of our fibre problem, our reticence around those bodily functions.
Well, I think it's that we don't talk about it. So people don't know what's normal, you know, because in polite company, you don't really talk about these things.
What is normal?
So, well, that farting one is interesting. Not that I recommend anyone have to actually count how many times they fart in the day, but it was somewhere in the region of, you know, 13 to 20 odd farts per day. But, you know, the thing is, I heard, funnily enough, I was on social media scrolling the other day and I saw this kind of carnivore guy talking about proudly that he had changed his diet to this very carnivore diet and he never farted. So he was trying to blame fibre. I think that's why it popped up in my feed. He was trying to blame fibre for farting and talking about it as if that was a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why you shouldn't eat it. And I had my head in my hands just shouting at my phone going, you're an idiot. It's not a good thing not to fart. You shouldn't be so proud about that. So farting is a sign that fermentation is going on. Obviously, if there's excessive and there's discomfort and there's bloating, but often those things, I think one of the funniest conversations I had was with a very well-known Australian gastroenterologist who was on one of my Brains Trust and one of the TV shows we did on gut health. And she said to me, you know, Joe, I honestly think of all the people I see in my clinic, one of the biggest problems people have with bloating and gut problems and discomfort and pain is that they're holding their farts in. And she told me the story that I think I retell this in the book about her patient who was a roofer. And so he spent most of his time outdoors. And she's quite correct. You know, if we think back to generations past, they spent a lot more time outdoors. Uh-huh. So farting was perhaps not such an issue. So now we're with people more often. We're inside, we're in closed rooms, double glazing, all this sort of stuff. It becomes less social to be able to let one out, you know. But so she described this roofer getting together with his fiance, and suddenly he was inside much more in this romantic environment. And it was his fiance who was complaining about how much he farted. So she had told him that he just had to, you know, remove himself from the room and go outside more. So there you go. That's my advice on this. You either have to take little fart walks outside or you politely excuse yourself to the bathroom, which is what my grandmother used to do, and then come back into the room. So there you go.
Gut health, and this, of course, is central to our conversation. And when we're talking about science, this is reasonably recent. Putting together the significance of what's going on in our biome.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think this is where really, you know, my brain lit up and thought, this is just extraordinary. I have to understand more about this. Was when research, you know, when I was first doing my Bachelor of Science, and then I did an Honours in Nutrition and Dietetics. And at that time, we really didn't learn a lot about the impact of nutrition on your brain. We just thought the brain was sort of this elusive thing that we didn't really understand. We had the first knowledge of the gut microbiome, but it couldn't be measured back then and not into the detail down to the species level and so on. Mm-hmm. But we knew it was there, we knew it played a function, but we didn't really understand all of the mechanisms. And so fibre was still largely thought of as being to do with gut health and to do with colon cancer. You know, the very first research trial I worked on was to do with broccoli and colon cancer. Showing the benefits, by the way, of broccoli. So eat your broccoli. But yes, we really didn't understand much. We sort of knew people ate better, had better brain health, but really those mechanisms or connections or how that worked wasn't really known. So fast forward to today, and it's thanks to the gut microbiome research that we really now can make those mechanistic connections and understand that the gut microbiome fermenting fibers and other things in your gut and your colon is actually sending all sorts of signaling molecules and signals via the vagus nerve up to your brain, and that impacts many aspects of brain health. Some of these compounds that travel in your blood can get across the blood-brain barrier, and they have a neuroprotective effect. They reduce inflammation in the brain. And then, of course, your brain actually needs nutrients too, and many of those nutrients will come from animal foods. So that brings us back to that animal-plant balance. So, in fact, we now understand a lot about brain health and how we can not just improve our long-term brain health in terms of reducing your risk of dementia and other forms of like Alzheimer's and even Parkinson's potentially, but we also know that we can impact our brain performance from day to day. You know, I'm in my early 50s now, and the number of women in my age group who are talking about brain fog and all that sort of stuff that happens around perimenopause and menopausal years, and I'm sure men get some of these impacts too. That is very much also impacted by your diet. So that sort of link now between the gut and the brain is just fascinating. And I think there's still so much we have to learn about it, but we're starting to really understand what can move the needle in terms of making a difference.
Well, let's talk about moving the needle, because having listened to all this, I'm now seized with the question of what do I do?
Yes. Well, you start by eating more fiber. And I have never been a fan, whether it's calories, protein, carbs, of counting grams of anything. So although I give the recommendation of, you know, roughly 30 grams a day of fiber, I don't recommend. You don't need to start counting the grams.
What does that look like, though? I mean, 30 grams of broccoli?
What it looks like across the course of the day is basically, our dietary guidelines are under review, but if you follow a largely whole food diet, if you get your five different veggies, two different fruits, a handful of nuts and seeds, or not just nuts, and you choose whole grains over refined, and you're choosing what I call a smart carb into each meal, which is about a quarter of this of your plate, then you're going to hit your fiber targets. Mm. I think a nicer way to think on it, and one way that it is not often I've heard talked about, is the diversity of fibers you need. And that's where I come to which is a much more fun way of looking at it, is your 30 plus plant foods a week. So, you know, we've all got a bit of a tendency to buy the same things. I mean, I don't know about you, Jonathan, but when I go to the supermarket, I do tend to go, okay, I always have spinach, I always have red capsicum, you know, I always buy red onions, etc. So try and buy different things. You know, every now and again, throw a different veggie in there, or try making something. You know, I made Jerusalem artichoke soup recently because I had it on an aeroplane and went, oh my goodness, that's delicious. So, you know, just try something different. And actually, it's a fun exercise, and it's a nice little challenge to just jot down on your phone or in a notebook every time you have a different plant food, and see what you're getting to across the course of the week. And that gives you fiber diversity, which is actually just as important as the total grams of fiber. So really what I hope people get, the message throughout the book, is that food should be a wonderful part of our lives, of our days. That word roughage just conjures up cardboard and bran and, you know, things that are not
terrible
exciting. But if I talk to you about, you know, raspberries and blackberries and pomegranate, you know, cocoa is an extraordinary source of fiber. You know, it's deliciousness, and it's broccoli, and it's, you know, you may not share my love of Brussels sprouts, but I bet you if I cooked them for you nicely, then you would like them. So I
adore Brussels sprouts.
Oh, I'm glad you're on the page with me. Usually I say Brussels sprouts are my favourite vegetable and people look at me like I'm mad.
You know things in your gut. That gut, it's the core of us. That's more than a gut feeling. And we're running out of excuses for not giving that gut's broader embodiment, our biome, the things it needs to play its part in keeping all our systems in good order. Science is clear and getting clearer that the message is, say hi to fibre, to chew with a little more consciousness. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Joanna McMillan. Her new book is called The Fibre Factor, a science-backed guide to a healthier gut, stronger heart and sharper brain. It's out now. And you can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National at any time at all on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And share us around. In fact, why not take this episode and share it with a friend? You may have a friend who is a little subpar in the fibre stakes. Well, pop it in an email or pop it in a text. Send them a link. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at everybite, all one word, at abc.net.au. Everybite at abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jirik. I'm Jonathan Green.